All right, we're back. Representative Paymar or Representative Hillstrom?
We have an offer, and Mr. Walt will walk through the spreadsheet. And
you even have a spreadsheet?
Pretty good.
We are good.
Mr. Waltz?
Mr. Chair, before I get started, while these are being passed out, I've been instructed to make note of one particular item. The spreadsheet that you are being handed will highlight changes from the last Senate position, just to be clear. And there is a placeholder for the data integration project in the Supreme Court on lines 8 and 9 that the House is not currently agreeing to. They're waiting for further instruction from leadership whether or not this would be okay. This was something that was not heard in the House. So this is a placeholder at this time, but this is not something that's agreed to by the House.
Understood. Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, if everyone now has a copy, the changes that we have made are in darker shaded lines, and so those are the only ones that I'm going to go over. The first change is on line 15. The past couple offers have had an increase for civil legal services of $1.25 million. That is double the House. That was over double the House in the governor's position. The House has chosen to remove $250,000 a year in funding from that position and bring that to $1 million even per year. On line 27, the House suggests adding back in the appeals court judge reimbursement for $46,000. On line 37, the House removes $25,000 in funding per year to the specialty courts to bring that down to $900,000 per year. Moving on to the Public Defense Board, the numbers appear slightly different. But just so there's no confusion, this includes the governor's position for increase in the public defender on line 79, the House's original position of $1.9 million addition to replace the $75 fee on attorney's licenses, and it includes the House position on catch-up for the transcripts in 2014, and then the Senate's ongoing position of additional money for transcripts beginning in 2015. Mr. Chair, moving on, the next change is on page 4, line 151. Line 150. The House includes the one-time money for the community offender reentry project in Duluth. Goes back to the House's position on money for local grants for sex traffic victim training, $375,000 per year. And removes the juvenile detention alternative and community safety de-escalation grants on lines 152 and 153. Mr. Chair and members, the next change is on line 5. The House removes some of the savings that were retained by the Department of Corrections for MA savings. And transfers some of that savings to the second year to increase the department's ongoing savings. So the savings to the department that they retain in 2014 is $500,000. The ongoing figure would be $2,776,000 per year, and that begins in 2015. Mr. Chair, then the final change is on the last page. The House includes the court technology fee on line 274. The intent of this would be an ongoing fee. There is not any money in the tails. That was just an initial. Mr. Chair, that completes the House changes.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. There's also some policy pieces that we need to have Ms. Perius go through.
Mr. Chair, members, since we didn't make it back over, I'm just working off of Mr. Backus's Senate counteroffer, the non-rider items. So for the court technology fee, we would like the House position. The criminal traffic surcharge has already been agreed to. Conciliation, court fee.
I'm sorry, can you start? Repeat that. Are you working off of this, or what are you working
on? Oh, I'm sorry.
That one. Okay. Thank you.
So, titled Senate counteroffer, non-rider items. So I'll just start over. The court technology fee, house position, the traffic surcharge has already been agreed to. Conciliation court fee increase except the Senate position. The Court of Appeals judge reimbursement house position. And the bond forfeiture fee except the Senate position. Moving on to Article 3, the Guardian and Conservators take the Senate offer of accepting the House, or sorry, take the Senate position on the no appropriation. Is that correct? Yeah.
With the House language.
With the House language, thank you. Do you want to do the rest? I'll keep going. The Trunk Highway Fund, accept the Senate position. And then we already have two identical provisions agreed to. The fifth degree, I think, is still a work in progress. The mandatory sentence for repeat sex offenders, House position. The civil legal services rider, Senate position, accept that. The House position has been agreed to on the juvenile justice system report. The judicial salary, accept the Senate provision with the House numbers. And then the final, I believe the House position was agreed to on the interagency agreement.
Ms. Pierce, members, I think there may have been a misunderstanding in my final comment just as we were going into recess. I wasn't suggesting that we were going to accept the whole House position, but that additional language that you had talked about.
The cap.
Yeah, the cap language was something that we thought was a good idea to include. And if I conveyed it inarticulately, I apologize for that.
I believe that concludes the offer, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair, the
Senator Paymar.
I know that Senator Goodwin and yourself and others had some issues with the MnCASA proposal, and I've talked to the staff at MnCASA, and they're going to work with Mr. Diebel and Ms. Pierce to see if we can't come up with something that is satisfactory, at least to. You know, and then maybe come back again next year and have a full hearing in both bodies again and get it worked out. But at least to get, I mean, I think the intent is pretty clear that we're looking to try to deal with patterned behavior that even if you're a young person that needs to stop. And so whether it's the 15-year or 10-year limit or whether we drop the felony, I don't know, however we want to work. But let's just see if we can't find some language that is workable at this point. Mr. Diebel? I don't know if we can resolve it tonight, but if you want to just throw out what you have so far. Mr. Chair, could you call it, Mr. Diebel?
Thank you. Yeah, I'm a little unclear. You said something about next year, and now you're also talking about language now. So help me.
Mr. Chair, I was just
maybe
trying
I should ask Mr. Diebel to explain.
Yeah, would you please? Because I was just trying to see if there was some middle ground we can find to at least keep this provision alive.
Mr. Diebel?
Mr. Chair and members, the working proposal is on the draft that was distributed earlier that's timed 7 p.m. from the MnCASA, if everyone has that in front of them. I'll give you a minute to grab it if you don't have it.
Okay. Members all have the 5/13/13, 7 p.m. draft in front of them. It's two pages stapled. All right, Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair and members, the proposal would be to make a couple changes to this language. In subdivision 2, paragraph B, you delete the 15-year look-back period and restrict it to a 5-year look-back period on the gross misdemeanor, and that would allow for the extended probation, but the offenses would need to be committed within 5 years of each other rather than the initial proposal of 15 years. The other change would be in subdivision 3 under the felony provision, delete paragraph B, which would be the look-back period on that. And then the existing language of that felony subdivision, you'd keep the new language, which is the current repeat violation elevating to a felony, but it would add other serious prior sex offenses to the list, and that would make it consistent with paragraph B in subdivision 2. So you'd be looking at the same offenses under both the gross misdemeanor and the felony offense.
Does that conclude the proposed changes, Mr. Diebel?
Yes, and I just add, Mr. Chair, that subsection 2 would need to be retained because that's a conforming amendment that reflects the changes in subdivision 2, but no changes to that section.
Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, I certainly improvement here, but I'd also like to take out in paragraph B under subdivision 2 the adjudication of delinquency. Now, that's the language, if I'm not mistaken, that talks about juvenile crime, or what is talking about juvenile crime. I would just like to say that let's stick with this for adult behavior. I would like to do that. I think that's a big improvement, taking out the other stuff until we get a really good chance to take a look at it. But I would like to leave the juvenile. And I think there are things that we need to do with juveniles that start showing sexual deviance, but I definitely think we need to do treatment and maybe probation, but I'm not sure that we need to do 6 years of, or count that as part of their or is that taken out here? Did you take out the number of times they have to have been convicted?
That would show propensity.
Mr. Chair,
how that is, what that is right now, because I don't understand. Does this still have that? Is that gross misdemeanor language under subdivision 2? Is that after a second conviction, or for the second conviction, or what is that for? Or the very first conviction? What is that for?
Mr. Diebel.
Mr. Chair, members, Senator Goodwin. So there would need to be a previous conviction for one of the more serious sex offenses that are listed in paragraph B of subdivision 2. So one prior conviction for within 5 years of the violation of the fifth degree clause 1. So then if your suggestion for deleting the or adjudication of delinquency, it would need to be an adult, treated as an adult offense. It could have been committed by a juvenile, but they would have had to have been certified as an adult, so which would require a serious offense, and but would eliminate it, the delinquency adjudications for prior convictions.
So, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair.
So, Mr. Chair, maybe...
Representative Paymore.
I'm just wondering if Senator Goodwin wants to... if this language is okay with MnCASA, as described by Mr. Diebel, if that language is okay, then we could maybe by tomorrow, Senator Goodwin, if you want to offer some different language when we're all a little... when our heads are a little clearer.
All right, we'll contemplate it overnight. How's that sound, Representative Bush?
Sure, just for between now and tomorrow. It still does not address my fact scenario, which would be addressed by deleting Subdivision 3, Clause A.
Mr. Chair, may I clarify something?
Ms. Palmer.
So Subdivision 3A, that actually already exists in the statute. We added some additional priors, but that's actually language that's already in law.
So,
Representative Lush.
Madam Chair, just to clarify, if you can get a felony now under current law for actions under Subdivision 1, Clause 2.
Where?
Is that currently punishable by felony?
Fifth degree.
Good question.
No, I don't think so.
Okay, what are we looking at? I got fifth degree up here.
Maybe Mr. Diebel can answer that for us. Are there any felony offenses currently under a fifth degree?
Yes. I pulled up Section 609.3451, criminal sexual conduct in the fifth degree, felony. A person is guilty of a felony and may be sentenced to imprisonment for not more than 5 years or to payment of a fine of not more than $10,000 or both if it violates Subdivision 1, which is crime defined. Clause 2, the person engages in masturbation or lewd exhibition of the genitals in the presence of a minor under the age of 16, knowing or having known the person is a minor. So,
yes,
kind of appears it's already a...
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Let me make a suggestion. We're trying to rewrite a whole felony statute here with a complicated predicates at 11:30 at night as part of a conference where so many of these issues were raised in our Judiciary Committee that the committee unanimously laid it on the table. Mm-hmm. I appreciate the efforts to try to revive it, but we got questions from both sides of the table here that are uncomfortable with various aspects of this bill. And I'm not sure I'm comfortable trying to reach any consensus on this anymore. It's not a good...
Mr. Chair,
are you uncomfortable with us?
I think we have a subcommittee or something and let them work it out with about four of them and come back.
Mr. Chair.
You know, of the conference committee?
Well, no, I mean work on this over the interim of from now until tomorrow and come back with something or just dump it all together.
Mr. Chair.
Between now and tomorrow morning, who volunteers to stay up?
Sure, we're not going to finish tomorrow morning.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodwin.
I would just agree with you that this isn't the time or the place to go into this significant of changes to statute and it's a policy issue more than it is a financial issue. And I know we have kind of both in this bill now, but I really would... I think we need to really spend some time thinking about this. And maybe the whole fifth degree thing needs to be changed because it is... I mean, someday. I'm not talking about in this bill. But I'm also thinking that this is
soon to. We have too little time to do this.
All right, I'd like to move on from this provision, if we may.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to make it clear that that really was part of the House's offer for the Senate to consider, and I would assume that when you bring back your offer, if that's not part of the next offer you counter with, that there would be some other changes. I would assume that you may make to this provision or to something else in the offer that you counter with. But that was part of the House's offer.
To rewrite the provisions?
Yeah.
Tonight?
Mr. Chair, to offer a compromise on the language.
Okay, well, I sense there's some concern even among your members about the proposed compromise language as well as among some of the Senate members. So that's why we have more extensive hearings in the Judiciary Committee over criminal policy. So, well, I guess we'll give you our response when we counter the offer.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Representative Paymar.
We skipped over line 212, and I don't know if that was intentional. I don't think it was, but... for your bill, early release, and that was we did not want to.
I could get an alternate.
Your early release of non-violent drug offenders. There was a small savings of that provision.
It was in their first offer to accept. Yeah.
Representative Paymar, it was our understanding and consulting with Stafford that it was in the House's first offer to accept that provision, and that our counter was only with regard to the provisions we disagreed with. But I would assume that's the Senate language that was part of the House offer. The House had different language, which was quite a bit milder, shall we say. I'm not sure if you can book the same savings with the or even more restrictive qualifying criteria for the program. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I believe in the first written offer it did have the House's language as part of that offer, Mr. Chair. And it's my understanding from talking to corrections, I believe that under the House's language, two people would qualify for the program, and under the Senate language, five people would qualify for the program, and every one of those people already qualify for CIP, Mr. Chair. And so I don't know that you're going to get any savings anyways, because all of them can go to boot camp, Mr. Chair.
Well, all right, we will, I guess that calls into question that line on the spreadsheet. Well, perhaps we ought to consider that question. Let's ponder that for a moment. I've got a question for Ms. Marshall or some other representative from the courts with regard to the Court of Appeals reimbursement proposals. Can we get? I'd like to seek some clarification on that, please.
Hello. For the record, I'm Dawn Torgerson, Deputy State Court Administrator for the Judicial Branch.
Thank you. Ms. Torgerson, I think you were here and heard some of the conversation with regard to the proposal to reimburse Court of Appeals judges for housing and mileage. Could you clarify for us what the current statute is with regard to that reimbursement?
What the current statute currently states is that we will provide the reimbursement for only 2 years.
Okay. And has any Court of Appeals judge come to the Judicial Council seeking to change that proposal, that statute of practice?
No, they have not.
And how far back does that conclusion go? I mean, the last year or the last 5 years, do you know?
It's been quite some time. I don't think they've ever, according to Janet, ever have come requesting that change be made to the legislation, to the statute.
According to Ms. Marshall?
Yes.
Okay, I see Ms. Marshall's nodding her head back there. Okay, for the record. nodding her head up and down. In a sense. Representative Hillstrom?
Mr. Chair, if Ms. Marshall is in the room and someone's speaking on behalf of Ms. Marshall, maybe Ms. Marshall should just speak for herself.
Well, fair enough. Ms. Marshall, we'll put you on the record here.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Janet Marshall with the State Court Administrator's Office, and we have never had a Court of Appeals judge come asking us to seek that the legislation be changed from the current 2-year reimbursement.
Okay. And Ms. Marshall or Ms. Torgerson, you heard the statement in committee here that judges run for re-election within their congressional districts. Is that your understanding of the law?
No, our understanding of the law is that they run statewide.
Hey, any chance can you give us a statutory cite, or can you find it for us?
I don't have that, but we could get that.
Okay, so even though they're appointed to a seat and originally out of a particular congressional district, is it congressional district or judicial district? How does that work?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, the Court of Appeals judges, they have to be appointed from within the congressional district. They have to live within the congressional district originally, and then they run for re-election on a statewide basis.
Okay.
And we will get you the statute.
All right. And I actually seem to recall, Congressman Mingy who had an issue with this a decade ago? And the line got changed? I don't recall. I might be misremembering this. And then about the history of that requirement, when did that come into effect?
Appointment from the congressional district requirement, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
That was part of the original legislation that was negotiated when we began the Court of Appeals back in the early 1980s.
Okay, so not when it went from 11 to 19 members, but the very initiation of the Court of Appeals itself?
Mr. Chair, yes.
All right. Thank you. I think we may have the statute here. 480A.02. All judges, subdivision 4, all judges shall be subject to statewide election whether they serve in at-large or congressional district seats. Any further questions for Ms. Torgerson or Ms. Marshall? Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Marshall, maybe. This request has been in now. I originally put it in 2011 and then reintroduced the bill this session. So the judiciary has at least had awareness for over 2 years now that the Court of Appeals judges from Greater Minnesota were requesting this change. Are you aware that this bill has been introduced for over 2 years now?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Representative, yes, we knew it was introduced for 2 years. When the judge, who it was our understanding, originally talked to people about it was only him who asked for this, not the five Court of Appeals judges, and again, he never came to the Judicial Council and asked us to include it in the budget. He chose this route instead.
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair, maybe, Mr. Chair, you could explain to the conferees, why your position has changed over the past 2 years, because you were a co-author to this identical language when this bill was introduced in 2011. I believe Thomas Oney was the chief author at that point, if I remember correctly.
I know.
Reiner.
Senator Reiner was.
And you were the co-author to this exact same language. So, you know, perhaps you could explain why your position has changed on it. Sure. I didn't realize it was so controversial.
Well, I gave it some additional thought, and I changed my mind. You know, I learned more about it. I thought more deeply about the consequences of it and all the different aspects of it, and frankly, I just reached a different conclusion. So before we came to conference committee, because I wasn't on the bill this last time around.
Right. Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, I guess I'd like to hear, you know, what you think the potential consequences are of this legislation. You know, I understand that the judiciary has an internal process that they go through, and they could do this internally. We wouldn't have to do it legislatively. Personally, I would have preferred had they done it that way. You know, but the fact of the matter is, you know, I think the conversations that the Greater Minnesota Court of Appeals judges have had among each other and the fact that they've been pursuing this legislatively for over 2 years now, the judiciary has made it pretty abundantly clear to them that it's not something they're willing to do for them. So then their only option is to do it legislatively, of course. So, you know, I'm still not seeing what the sort of great consequences would be if we allow Greater Minnesota Court of Appeals judges to have the same housing and mileage reimbursements that legislators from Greater Minnesota have. And although they run in a statewide election, if, for example, the 8th Congressional judge was just up for re-election this last time around, and whoever runs against him has to live in the 8th district as well. So it is a statewide election, but that seat has to be filled by somebody from the 8th Congressional district. And the statute also says that they have to reside in one of the 8 congressional districts for at least a year prior to appointment or election. So there is some pretty strict residency requirements as far as how long they have to live and reside in the congressional district. And that's been in place since 1984, I believe. So those were the, you know, policy considerations behind setting it up that way. So, I mean, I guess I just don't have the same concerns you do, but I'd be interested to hear what your concerns are and what you think the potential consequences would be.
Sure. Well, my concerns are severalfold. One is, it seems to me if you accept a job that requires a change in location, I mean, you accept the job knowing that, and you've made a decision that you're prepared to move your professional life to a different city. And that doesn't automatically entitle you. I don't think it ought to automatically entitle you to maintain a residence where you came from. If I took a job in Duluth, I wouldn't expect my employer to pay for me to keep a house in St. Louis Park if I were working full-time in Duluth. In fact, there's no way they would do that unless they really, really wanted me, I guess. Pretty unlikely. And then there's also a bit of concern about the process. I'm uncomfortable end running the court system on this, especially if the judges did not avail themselves initially in going through the process in the court system. A third, they're very different than legislators. And I guess I've said this before, but I'll say it again. I mean, we have a constitutional obligation to live in the district that we represent. And we are a part-time job.
Well,
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just want to make it really clear that currently expenses of judges is part of Minnesota statute 484.54, subdivision 2, expense payments. A judge shall be paid travel and subsidy expenses for travel from the judge's place of residence to and from the judge's permanent chambers only for a period of 2 years as provided by the Judicial Council policy. So we actually did adopt in statute the number of years by which it should be. So even if the Judicial Council decided to change the policy, the statute would need to be changed because, in fact, we have put it in Minnesota statute. So it is appropriate to put these pieces in statutes as displayed currently.
Well, I'm not saying it's not appropriate to put it in statute. But I would interpret the current statute as being transitional in purpose, that someone gets appointed to be a judge and they would presumably take their job in fairly quick order. They might not be able to get their home sold right away, or they've got some time of transition for a spouse to find a new position if that's what they're going to do, or for kids or whatever. But at some point, the full-time job in St. Paul, and why the taxpayers should be asked to subsidize two homes for someone who's got a full-time job in St. Paul, I have a problem with that. In the long run, I mean, they can serve on the Court of Appeals for 15, 20 years, or however long they remain subject to the mandatory retirement age. I don't know. Should everyone who has a job with the state be entitled to a subsidy so they can maintain a cabin up on Rainy Lake? I don't see it.
Well, Mr. Chair, let's just make it clear that is part of the House's offer, so I assume that when you make a counteroffer, if that's how you feel, you'll be making a counteroffer for us to consider whether or not we'll accept your counteroffer.
We've already made our counteroffer on that point a couple times. We'll make it again.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Moline.
And I know I said this before, but, you know, I think to compare it just to a regular job, obviously any Minnesotan can take a regular job wherever they want in the state or working for the state of Minnesota, but these are elected positions in the third branch of government. So I don't think that it can just be compared to taking any job in St. Paul. It is an elected position. And if the people of Minnesota want to elect a Court of Appeals judge who lives north of Duluth or in Walker or Owatonna, you know, then they're doing that knowing where that person's place of residence is. And, you know, I do think that there's a public policy interest in having greater Minnesota represented in our third branch of government. And, you know, right now, like I mentioned before, we do have trouble getting people to apply for these positions because they end up making less money than district court judges, having to maintain a residency near their chambers in St. Paul. So I don't think that it can be compared to just taking any old job in St. Paul. It is an elected position in the judiciary.
Yeah. Well, Representative Moline, you asked me to articulate the basis for my position, at least my thinking on the policy subject. I understand what you're saying, and we're lawyers, both of us. We could probably go on debating the merits back and forth for the rest of the night. I'm not sure how productive that is, and I'm not sure that that necessarily foretells what the ultimate position would be with regard to this item in the proposed budget. But you asked for the basis for the position I come at this from, and so I've articulated it that way so that you understand. But I understand what you're saying, and I see that there's some merit to distinguish it from a private sector job. Certainly, the question is whether that's enough to justify the taxpayer expense under the circumstances, and for on a permanent, ongoing basis for all five of the qualifying Court of Appeals judges rather than for a transitional period. And so I think that's a public policy question that we're facing at this point, separate in part from the fact that we don't have it in the – we haven't taken it up on the Senate side in terms of our legislative process. Representative Hillstrom or Senator Dzik? Senator Dzik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question was, and the reason I have some concern with it is it goes from 46 to 115, and so that more than doubles. And so how do they figure out? And then the tails go up from there to 135, and so it's that increased tails. And how did they just decide this year 46 and next year 115? Explanation to that?
Representative Moline.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dzik, that was explained. I don't think you were in conference committee yet, but the reason that they did that was because there is the reimbursement for the first 2 years. So some of the newer judges from Greater Minnesota that are currently on the court are still in that two-year grace period, and once they phase out of that, then there'll be the increased cost in the tails, and then the judiciary is expected that it'll level out at the $135,000. I frankly think the estimate is on the high end. That's just my opinion, but that's why you see the increase for the phasing out from the judges that are currently under the two-year grace period.
Senator Dzik.
I have another question. This might be from Ms. Marshall. Do they Again, because it goes back and forth, so I'm a little confused. Are they required to keep their house in their original seat because it is a statewide election? So are they required to keep that, or is that choice? How does that work?
Ms. Marshall.
Mr. Chair, Senator, no, they are not required. That is a choice that they make.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to make the announcement that we will meet tomorrow at 9:30 in this room.
You foreshadowed a question I was going to have to ask you before we resolve tonight anyway. Are there any other questions, Senator Limmer?
Mr. Chair, on this issue of appellate court reimbursement, is that similar to the same situation for, let's say, the Supreme Court? Is the Supreme Court elected in the same way or appointed in the same manner as the appellate? Why is that unique?
Representative Moline?
Mr. Chair and Senator Limmer, there's no requirements that Supreme Court justices come from any particular congressional district or have any sort of geographic representation. That's unique to the Court of Appeals. It was a policy decision at the time, but no, there's not the same residency requirements for the Supreme Court.
Okay. I think
Did we finish going through the House offer?
That's a great question. I believe we did finish going through the House offer, yes. Ms. Marshall, you're familiar with the House proposal to levy a technology fee, a $2 fee on each motion or filing fee, as I understand it. From what I understand, the fiscal note doesn't necessarily match up with the language, but the fiscal note was assuming that that fee would be added on top of every traffic surcharge, conciliation court filing, motion fee, filing, everything is filed with the court. Is that your understanding, and what is the court's position with regard to the fee itself and the mechanism for distributing it?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have taken no official position on the fee itself. In terms of our understanding, the money that was included in the spreadsheet would apply the fee to all of court administration fees, conciliation court, appellate court filing fees, and both the criminal traffic and the parking surcharge. And that language would have to be tweaked a little bit to be able to accomplish that, or the revenue in the bill would have to go down.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Chair, originally the fiscal note was to match the language that was in the bill, and then they updated that fiscal note to say that there needed to be a tweak. And so if the language is the way it is currently in the bill, it's a loss of $2 million, about $2 million to $2.5 million. If it is tweaked to match what Ms. Marshall stated, that's what it would have to be to get the full amount in the technology fund, Mr. Chair.
What is the House's proposed position on that, then?
Mr. Chair, the first offer that we made has the technology fee with the tweak that was required by the court to actually match the fiscal note, and that was the offer that we again made this time.
Ms. Marshall, does the court have any position with regard to the utilization of the funds that are generated from such a fee?
Mr. Chair, I'm not quite sure I understand your question. I do know two things about the funds. And the first is that people have to keep in mind that this is a special revenue account, so the funds cannot be spent till there's money in the bank, so to say. So it will be a while before there's any money that we could distribute to people. We do have one concern with the distribution, and that is the language as written provides that judicial districts can apply for this money. And as we have discussed, with Representative Hillstrom, that would preclude the State Court Administrator's Office, who is currently responsible for funding all of the court's technology, from applying for a grant.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And it's my understanding that you also wanted the change from the Supreme Court to distribute the money to the Judicial Court, Judicial Council, to be able to distribute the money. I believe that that's the other tweak that you requested. And Mr. Chair,
is that right, Ms. Marshall?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hillstrom, yes, that is. That one's not as important as the other two we just discussed.
And Mr.
But that would be good.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Chair, I've attempted to work with them through the entire process, and I have no objection to meeting their needs through the fee.
Do we have any other circumstances? Does anyone know where the legislature appropriates money to the judicial branch for a designated purpose for redistribution, sort of a grant process to within and without the judicial branch? Ms. Torgerson?
Mr. Chair, Civil Legal Services works in that manner, where the funds are appropriated and then Civil Legal Services distributes those as grants.
My understanding is that's basically a straight pass-through, isn't it? We appropriate X number of dollars to the courts. They do a pass-through in the exact same amount to Civil Legal Services, and then Civil Legal distributes it on their own. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. All right, and just to be clear, it's the House's position then that this proposed fee would apply to all parking tickets, all criminal and traffic surcharges, all conciliation court filing fees, and so on?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Chair, originally it was our intent that it applied to the pieces that we wanted, but ultimately we needed to generate that amount of revenue. And so we are open to discussions with the Senate if you have concerns about which particular pieces. But ultimately, we are attempting to have an ongoing revenue source for technology to meet the needs. Again, we've already heard the public defender's need alone is $2.5 million in the first 2 years, $7 million after that to implement just their piece. Otherwise, it'll come out of their budget lines in the future, Mr. Chair. So we need to make certain that it's an adequate stream to actually implement the technology pieces.
Unless we separately appropriate a technology piece to the public defenders out of the general fund, then it would not necessarily come out of their budget line.
Certainly, Mr. Chair, but at this point we don't have that in our budget. It's $2.5 million in this biennium.
Well, there's a broader issue about getting government up to speed technology standpoint, but we've only got our piece within this budget division.
I'm just doing my part, Mr. Chair.
No doubt. Okay, well, it's 5 to midnight, and we've covered a lot of territory today, and I think at least we're working off of a stronger set of common facts for a lot of this stuff, and I appreciate the hard work of everyone at the table and those in the room that have been watching this. I think the ball is in the Senate's court now to respond, and unless there's a interest or willingness on the part of the members of the conference committee to go for another hour, which I'm willing to do, but obviously it's under rules, it's not my decision. It's the committee has to decide if we wish to go past midnight. We can either convene as a Senate conferees and bring back a proposal yet tonight, or we can plan on doing that at 9:30 tomorrow morning. So I guess I'll ask what the...
You do have finance at 8:30 tomorrow, so I don't know if the Senate can bring back a proposal by 9:30.
Yeah, and I don't know how long that will go. I'm hoping it'll go smoothly. It won't take the whole hour, but we can do our best in that regard. Is there any preference on the part of the members here?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator Goodman.
Maybe if we just met, we could have a counteroffer by tomorrow and go to it, you know. Quickly, we would have to because we have session tomorrow. We've got some very controversial bills, so that will take some time.
Mr. Chair.
All right, Representative Hillstrom.
What time do you go into session?
I think it's 11.
11, I think, 11? Tomorrow.
The caucus at
10.
The caucus
at 10. The
caucus
at 10. Well, Mr. Chair, it would.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It would be helpful if then we could have a Senate offer to walk through as soon as we come in at 9:30, so that then when you go in to your caucus at 10 o'clock, we would have the ability to look at your offer and potentially make a counteroffer. And it would be my intention to try to move this along and wrap this up as soon as we can tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. It's been my intention to do the same, and we fully fleshed out a few issues today, which I think was valuable for our final decision making. All right, well then I think that's about all we can accomplish today. Thank you all, and we are now adjourned.